Thank you for coming today. We're going to go ahead and start studying the book of Hosea this winter. The class over the winter that we had, I know I thought it was really good, and I really appreciated all the different brothers who taught a class, and it was very encouraging, and I think we can be assured that we're going to see some of those guys again. So that'll give you hope, because I'm going to teach at least for the next few weeks. I'm scheduled here. The elders took a little kind of informal survey based on the class outlines that I had prepared, asking for the classes that would be the most interesting to everyone. And we're going to study the book of Hosea this spring. Turned out to be a very popular choice. And later in the year, we're going to have a class on the history of Christianity. Those proved to be the most popular choices. I think it will work out well because the book of Hosea gives us a very good parallel for the relationship that God has had with his people through the centuries. It gives us a very good image of what it's really like for us as the people of God, as opposed to the kind of artificial ideal that humans always have of how great they're going to be in serving God. The book of Hosea teaches us some important lessons on God's side of our relationship with him, on what it's like to be God, trying to love and be compassionate to and be merciful to a bunch of human beings who are kind of inherently subject to their own desires, to their own whims, to their own struggles. So we're going to start here just with a little introduction. We're going to look at the theme verse of Hosea, which is in chapter 6, verse 6, and then we're going to look at a couple passages where Jesus uses that scripture, and then we're going to get into the actual book of Hosea verse by verse. Before we do any of that, Steve is going to lead us in a short time of prayer, get one of our newly minted elders to call you to order, and to get everyone convened properly, and then we shall start our class.
Lord, we give you thanks that we have this opportunity to gather together to remember you, to open our hearts to you, to fill our hearts and our minds with you. Lord, let us rejoice at the opportunity to commune with you and with each other. Lord, we pray that you'll bless Mark with the understanding and the ability to share that understanding with us this morning, that will help each of us, will encourage each of us. And Lord, let us not just leave this message here today, but help us to take it deep into our hearts and deep into our lives so that we can use it and live by it day by day. We love you with all our hearts, Lord. We're so grateful for your grace. In Christ's name.
Amen. Thank you very much. Let's just read this one verse in Hosea, just to kind of get an idea in our mind. Bob, since you have that there, could you go ahead, just chapter 6, verse 6. And then what we're going to do is move from there to the book of Matthew and just read a couple of brief passages there. Dot, could you have Matthew 12, 1-8 ready? And then Lloyd, if you could cue up Matthew 9, 9-13. For now, just Bob, if you read that verse, and then we'll get into the Matthews one by one.
Okay, Hosea 6, verse 6. For I desire mercy, not sacrifice, and acknowledgement of God, rather than burnt offering.
Okay, that's good. This is kind of the theme of the book of Hosea. It's part parallel, part prophecy, part poetry. I just made a big mistake. I did something that Ron always does, poetry, prophecy, and I'll think of some words that start with different letters. That's a slip up on my part right there. But it's kind of a panoramic, oh boy, another P word. It's kind of a broad look at a lot of things to kind of give us an image of what it's like for God pursuing a relationship with us. We like to think of ourselves as pursuing a relationship with God and all the noble things we're going to do and all the great things we're going to do for God and how great we are, and or either that or we fuss about our problems and tell other people what they're going to do, or we feel bad about ourselves. We're always focused on that end. Hosea tells us what it's like for God pursuing a relationship with us. And this is one of the things that we hope to get out of it, just for at least in a basic way to try to take our eyes a little bit off of ourselves. Now, Dot, if you would read this passage in Matthew 12, this verse is significant because Jesus happened to particularly like that verse, and he found it very useful in some of his own lessons. So we're going to read a couple of examples, starting with this one in Matthew 12.
At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent? I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath."
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, we're not going to delve into the details of this example. What we're really interested in is just the way that Jesus uses this verse. He says, if you had understood Hosea 6:6, what would have happened? Then you wouldn't have condemned the innocent. You wouldn't have fussed at these people. Now, the thing that's interesting, see, we're kind of, one of the reasons why we're going to talk about it a lot, because experience shows that when we talk a lot about the Pharisees, we become Pharisees. Because we talk about what snakes they were, and we feel superior to them, and we're not superior to them in any way. So we're not going to talk a lot about the Pharisees. One of the things to notice is that these disciples picking grain on the Sabbath, is that actually against the law? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You're not supposed to collect food for yourself on the Sabbath. You're supposed to have the brains to provide for yourself the day before, so that you don't have to pick food on the Sabbath. But Jesus still said they were innocent. And he quotes another example, back from history, back in the life of David, in the time when David was on the run from Saul. And he and some of his friends were on the run, and they didn't have anything to eat, and they showed up at the tabernacle, and the priest said, "Well, we got some consecrated bread here. I guess I could give it to you." Now, is that legal to give the consecrated bread to someone who's not a Levite? Absolutely not. And yet Jesus says it's okay. Here's one of the first things that it means to desire mercy, not sacrifice. See, we're so fixated on what are we allowed to do? What do we have to do? What do I have to do? What does that guy have to do? What are we legal that we realize that's not the highest priority to God. Even a very clear point of law, unmistakable, can be superseded by something that to God is more important, because he desires mercy above all. He desires compassion above all. So this is one of the things that Jesus is saying, that you had all this law and you didn't even realize that the law was secondary to some higher priorities. The law was only useful insofar as it fostered higher priorities. If you'd understood what Hosea 6:6 meant, you wouldn't have made that mistake. Next passage, Lloyd, could you read Matthew 9:9-13?
As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means: 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but the sinners.'"
Thank you very much. Here's another example, and here are the Pharisees showing up again. And this time they're upset because Jesus is having dinner with the sinners. And I can do that because Ron's not into rhyming, so I can use that without embarrassment. This time they're upset because Jesus is eating with a bunch of unclean people. Now, is a Jew supposed to eat with these tax collectors who've been hanging around with the Romans? Well, no, of course not. But here again, there's something more important. There's a principle that Jesus says, well, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. You know, these sinners, they're sick, they're scum, so I need to help them. You Pharisees, you're righteous, you're good, so I don't need to help you. No. I hope you realize that's not correct. I hope you realize that that's not what it is. The point that he's making is different. Everybody needs a doctor. Everybody is sick from sin. Everybody is an incurable sinner, incurably fleshly, and we all need Jesus. And Jesus is saying, I will go wherever I am wanted and needed. It doesn't matter whether there's a law against it or not, because that's the higher priority. And here again, we could dwell on the Pharisees and we could have a gay old time criticizing them. We have a much easier time recognizing the Pharisees in the Bible than the Pharisees today, because the Pharisees today have much better marketing groups. And so they have a much better way of presenting themselves. You know, the Pharisees today specialize in false grace. They talk about grace and then don't practice it. They talk about how they're not allowed to judge and then they go around judging people. It's kind of like one of the episodes of Linda's favorite show, I Love Lucy, one of the DVDs that she has. There's a show where Lucy's trying to help her neighbors, Fred and Ethel, because they've had a big fight. And Fred stormed out of the house and they don't want to be with each other anymore. And so Lucy's trying to help them and she says, well, now how did this fight start? And Fred, the husband, says, she said that my mother has a face like a weasel. And Lucy says, Ethel, that wasn't very nice at all. I think you should apologize to Fred. So Ethel says, okay. She turns over to her husband and says, Fred, I'm sorry that your mother has a face like a weasel. Well, that's the kind of false apology, false grace that we specialize in. I believe that we're saved by grace. I believe that we're saved by God's love. But here's what we need to do, and here's what you need to do, and here's what we need to be doing, and here's what we need to get after. In other words, you want to have it both ways. This guy over here, he doesn't believe the right things. I disagree with him and everything, but I can accept him as a brother. Oh, how noble of you. This guy over here is not doing as much as I think he should be. He's slacking off. I'm running around doing all these great things, but I accept him as a brother. How noble of you. When you have to say it, then you're not really living it, are you? When you have to, you're just offering an Ethel Mertz apology instead of a real apology. Well, again, so instead of condemning the Pharisees and talking at length about their mistakes in that, let's listen to Jesus, because he gives us something that we can do. He says, go and learn what this means. In other words, stop memorizing facts and figures and laws, but go and figure out what it means to, or what it means that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go and learn what it means. Now, before we go really get into the good part, we have to get out of the way Hosea 1, verse 1. And just since it's a fresh quarter, we all start off clean. I will read it for you, because it says, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. Now, just a very brief historical comments. We'll delve into a lot of history later in the year, and I know many of you are allergic to it to begin with. Occasionally, it helps to know the historical background in Hosea. Most of the time, it's actually not that crucial, because the message of Hosea is really timeless. But just so that you understand what he's talking about here, Hosea lived during the time when the nation of Israel was actually split into two parts. After Solomon died, which was in 931 BC, the nation split into two parts. There was a dispute as to who should be king after Solomon. And the northern half took its own kings and built a capital later in the city of Samaria and had their own history. The southern half took the name Judah after its line of kings. They kept the line of kings from David, and they kept the old capital in Jerusalem. And this is what's going on during Hosea's lifetime. Hosea probably was giving his messages sometime between 760 and 730 BC. And the book of Hosea in the old Hebrew Bible, it was collected with the other 11 short prophetic books at the end of the Old Testament, what we kind of misleadingly call the minor prophets. The term just goes back to an old Latin term that means the shorter prophetic books. It doesn't mean they're minor in any judgmental way. The Hebrew Bible, the ancient Bible, has one book at the end called the 12 prophets, or just the 12, which is Hosea and the other 11 little prophetic books at the end. they're kind of arranged in very rough chronological order. Those prophets at the end of the Old Testament cover about 350 or 400 years worth of history. And the ancient Jews like to think that this was kind of a nice supplement to the longer prophetic books, because guys like Isaiah and Ezekiel were just from one era. And so these shorter prophetic books, you kind of put them together, you get this panorama that paints a different picture. And during the era that Hosea lived, he gives you an image from this time when the nation was divided. And in fact, the northern half of Israel, the nation of Israel, fell in 722 BC, not long after Hosea was done prophesying. Now, because the name Israel is then, during his lifetime, is kind of ambiguous, because Israel really could mean the nation as a whole. Technically, it just meant the northern kingdom. They often referred to this northern kingdom by a couple of other names. You will see Hosea refer to Samaria. This does not mean the Samaritans, which we're familiar with in the New Testament. Samaria was just the capital city. So when he says Samaria, resist the urge to think Samaritans and think it just means the northern part of Israel. Sometimes he'll refer to it as Ephraim, which was the tribe that came to dominate the northern part of the kingdom. Sometimes he'll call it Ephraim. Now, these kings that he mentions, he lived in the north of Israel. Hosea lived in the doomed part of Israel. But it's interesting that the kings he mentioned, actually, the king of the north, Jeroboam II, was very successful as a secular ruler. He actually expanded Israel's borders considerably during his lifetime. They had a lot of prosperity. But he was an idolater. You can read about him back in the book of Kings, how God's point of view of him was, it was more important that he was an idolater than he was successful. He actually was pals with the prophet Jonah. Remember Jonah from the story about going to Nineveh. Jonah actually makes a brief appearance in the book of Kings. He was kind of the sidekick of King Jeroboam II. He would go around and prophesy the stuff that the king wanted him to prophesy. The kings of the south that he mentions here, some of these actually, their reigns extend well past the reign of Jeroboam. So it's very possible that Hosea's popularity rating in his native area dipped so much that he had to head down south for the rest of his career. So that just gives you a brief idea of the historical background. From time to time, that'll be important. There's a lot of other history from that era that I find very interesting, and most of you, it would bore you out of your skulls. So we're going to move on to Hosea 1, verse 2. And we'll have plenty more history later in the year, so you'll have to worry about that later. Chapter 1, verse 2, this is the heart of the book of Isaiah where we're picking up here. It's going to tell us about Hosea's wife and children. And it's interesting, the family life that he has is used deliberately by God as kind of a parallel of his relationship with his people. Isaiah marries this woman, who you'll see her name this, and just because I know we have some unrepentant Andy Griffith fans in here, Hosea's wife was not part of the U.S. Marine Corps. In fact, she would not have been welcome in the Marines, and she would not have been welcome in Mayberry either, for that matter. This, her name is Gomer. This is a woman's name. This was the wife of Hosea. He has three children, all of whom have symbolic names. Jezreel, which is a place that had a notorious significance in the history of Israel. And then he had two other children whose names are kind of similar, Lo-Ruhamah and Lo-Ami. This is Hosea's family that we're going to read about a little bit. So picking up in chapter 1, verse 2, I think it's only appropriate that Phil read verses 2 to 5. Actually, it's really appropriate that Phil would read the whole thing, because it's got a lot of these names, and Phil actually practices these at home because he knows that I'm going to call on him. So Phil, why don't you put into practice this policy of mercy and grace and save someone else the need to read this whole passage, verse 2 to 9, if you would.
When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go take yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest of the idolatry and departing from the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Dizalea, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to Hosea, "Call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel. I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. And that day I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel." Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo Ruhama, for I will no longer show love to the house of Israel, that I should at all forgive them. Yet I will show love to the house of Judah, and I will save them, not by bow, sword or battle, or by horses or horsemen, but by the Lord their God. After she weaned Lo Ruhama, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, call him Lo Amnon, for you are not my people, and I am not your God.
Now, what's the first impression you get out of that? Out of this family life to which God has called his faithful, devoted, spiritual prophet? Yeah, poor kids carrying around those names, and poor Hosea to have to put up with all this stuff. Well, the thing that he's doing is, and this is not unusual in the Bible. If you read Isaiah, or especially Ezekiel, God often used prophets and told them to, in their lives, go through some experiences that were very humiliating or very unpleasant or very hurtful as a way of visibly illustrating for the people something God wanted to teach. And in fact, this is what God is doing. He's saying, I would like you to try to see things my way. Instead of being so fixated about how good you think you are and about all the things you think you're going to be doing, I want you to see what it's like from my point of view. That's what it's doing. And in fact, really, that's the purpose of all the prophetic books in the Old Testament. They all, in one way or another, step back from the laws and the history and the facts to give a perspective and a set of priorities from God. Because as we saw in these examples from Matthew, the perspective and the priorities are more important than the laws or the facts or the history or our agendas or our desires or anything that we're thinking about. And this is what it's meant to do. Because it's so easy for us to look at things a certain way and make a lot of assumptions without ever realizing it. And in everyday life, it's usually pretty harmless. We all the time realize that someone else sees things much differently than we do. And sometimes it comes as a surprise. You know, we spend all our life passionately rooting for the Buckeyes and thinking that the Buckeyes are the team that everyone follows. And occasionally, you run into some heretic who likes some other team and is just as fanatical about that team as you are the Buckeyes. And it kind of surprises you. Most of the time, it's pretty harmful. But we can make assumptions that are so deep-rooted that we never bother to realize that there's a whole different way of looking at it. From a human point of view, well, human perspectives, really, none of them are better than any others. But the difference between our perspective and God's perspective is very important. You know, we tend to look at the way that we think and the way that we do things and think that it's universal, and it's not. Just real, real simple examples here. A couple of words that you might have, I don't think most of you have seen these words. If you happen to have seen these words, I'm not interested if you know what they mean so much as, do you think you know how to pronounce them? And if you happen to have seen them, give everybody else a chance to see if they think they can pronounce this. How do you think you'd pronounce this word? Weird looking, isn't it? What about this one? Well, in fact, this word is pronounced Ravno. And this word is pronounced Snova. They're not English words, they're Russian words. You see, in Russian, this is an R. This is a V. This is an N. Now, I'm sure you're thinking, isn't it just like those tricky Russians to use the wrong letters just so that when they write stuff, we can't figure out what they're up to over there? Well, they're not using the wrong letters. There's no metaphysical reason why this little symbol has to mean the letter H. There's no metaphysical reason why this little symbol has to mean the letter P. They're just as justified in using them to mean something entirely different. Well, that's really a trivial distinction. The point is that God has a perspective and a way of looking things that we never even bother to consider because we're so fixated on what we're supposed to be doing and what I'm supposed to be doing and what he's supposed to be doing and what I want to be and what I want to accomplish and what we think the church needs to be and what we think the church needs to be doing. Sometimes we forget all about God might have a whole different set alphabet out there. And the very words that we read sometimes can mean very different things to God than they do to us. And this is what God is going to use Hosea's family for. The prophet's wife, it's a kind of a shocking thing. God tells this faithful, righteous, compassionate prophet, go and marry a woman of unfaithfulness, an adulteress. In fact, it actually means prostitute. The word, the original Hebrew, and if you have some versions of the Bible, it will say prostitute. He actually says, go and marry a prostitute. The NIV kind of uses euphemisms a lot of the times that the older versions sometimes don't. Does that make any sense to you at all? You got this prophet, you got a great mission for him in life and a lot of spiritual messages, so you want to marry a prostitute. Well, no, it doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Well, it's a shocking way of helping us to see that just as Hosea, the faithful prophet, was called to build a loving, intimate relationship with a woman who was inherently unworthy of that, what is God trying to do with us? It's a way of trying to help us see, we are not Hosea. We are Gomer. We are the inherently faithless one, the one who is inherently tempted by the things of the world. And so the story of our relationship with God, we like to make it about the things we're doing and little tips and insights into how we can build a relationship with God. What Hosea, the book of Hosea is telling us, it's really the other way around. All the work is done on God's end. Our relationship with God is a story not of what we're doing to build a relationship with Him, but of what He does to build a relationship with us. What He does to clear away all the obstacles and to overcome all our folly in order to build the relationship with us. Now, these children that He has, and here again, in most English versions, they kind of use euphemisms, but I'll point something out. Since we don't have time to look at all the versions, I think many of you use the NIV. In verse 3, it says that Gomer conceived and bore him a son. In other words, his first son, the parents are Gomer and Hosea. But if you look down in verse 6, the NIV, all it says is Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. What's missing? They just kind of hope that you don't notice that. You know, they kind of, even Bible translators get kind of prudish. You know, they've never read the Song of Solomon, so they don't realize that God doesn't like to necessarily cover up the ugly realities of human life. And again, down in verse 8, after she'd weaned Lo Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. So, you see, the thing is that's going on here, this first son belongs to Gomer and Hosea. These second two are illegitimate children. And what does the faithful, compassionate prophet do? Takes them as his own. Takes them as his own because he is the image of God. In other words, God is not fixated on whether we're legitimate children or not. God just acts out of compassion. And this is why, just briefly, this is why Lucy, the Bible class goose, has put in a brief appearance in the class today. It's kind of interesting in nature, as a generality, mammals tend to be fixated on whether a young animal is theirs or someone else's. Human beings tend to be very fixated on it because we're mammals. Birds are usually not that way. Most birds will happily raise children just because they see the need. And in fact, Canada geese, which I'm always looking for a way to promote the interest of Canada geese because we have these Dick Cheney types like Lloyd who just want to go around and shoot them. Canada geese are especially good parents. I've seen geese will have maybe half a dozen of their own goslings at a time. But it's routine for geese and ducks and penguins and a lot of birds. If they see orphaned chicks, without a hesitation, they just gather them themselves. I've seen in the springtime one adult pair of geese with as many as 25 or more little goslings. Can't give you an exact count because those little goslings move too fast. But I've seen one pair of adult geese ushering around a group with at least 25 of them squirming around in there. Because the birds just act out of instinctive compassion. It doesn't matter to them who the real parents are. Well, in this case, God is more like a bird than a mammal. Because God's instinct is, I want a relationship with it. I want to take care of it. It doesn't matter to him where you come from, whether you're a legitimate child or not. It matters to us, but it doesn't matter to God. And one of the things that he does then is this child, Jezreel, gets this name because the Valley of Jezreel was kind of a notorious place in Israel's history. And you can read these. We don't have time to read these. But in 1 Kings 21, you'll read how Jezreel was the site of a man that owned this very nice vineyard that the king of Israel wanted for himself. And the king plotted to have the man killed so that he could grab it by himself. He was egged on by his wife Jezebel. Later, Jezebel was killed by the command of King Jehu, which is where this guy Jehu comes in that he mentions in verse 4. Jehu ordered that the queen be killed, and he actually had her body thrown to the dogs. The dogs ate her body as kind of a posthumous punishment for her sinfulness. Jehu, the king, was faithful in a sense, to the living God. He believed in the living God, but his way of doing things was very unique, to say the least, because he tricked all the priests of Baal to coming to Jezreel so that he could have them slaughtered. So this name Jezreel is kind of symbolic of what it's really like for God to have to deal with us. Even the people who believe in him really don't have very appropriate ways of expressing their beliefs in him a lot of times. The judging, the so-called righteous indignation, shoving each other around, making each other feel guilty, that's what God's got to put up with. We think we're doing it in the name of righteousness. We get all ahead of steam up, yeah, these people need to be straightened out over there. God just, oh my goodness, you know, it's a good thing that I'm a God who desires mercy, not sacrifice. That's why, even though, in a sense, this crude form of justice was done at Jezreel, God says, I'm going to have to teach a little bit of a lesson here. So this kid Jezreel carries around this very ambiguous name. Well, he got it a little bit better than his brother and sister, though, because these two really got stuck with bad names. Lo Ruhamah, in Hebrew, it means not pitied or not shown compassion or not shown mercy. Some versions will give you a little footnote that says not loved, which is kind of true, but it's not really as specific as the actual name means. It basically means I'm not having pity on you. You don't deserve pity. You don't deserve any sympathy. And then we have Lo Ami in Hebrew, means not my people. What he's saying, and this, you know, it sounds so harsh, yeah, but this is to help us to understand what it's like for God and his relationship with that. It's saying, by nature, even my people are not my people. By nature, even the Israelites have no claim to be my people. They're not by nature belong to me. They think they are, but they aren't. And it's interesting, if you read the original Hebrew, as I know you all do in your spare time, but if you read in the original Hebrew, in verse 9, when it says, you are not my people and I am not your God, it literally says in the Hebrew, I am not I am. Because that's one of God's names. He literally says, I am not I am. Because what he's saying is, my relationship with the people I created is so important to me that if they reject me, they reject my whole identity. That to God, it's so important to reach out to the people he created. His very identity to him is tied up not in the great acts of creation that he's done, not in the wonderful power that he has, but in his desire to be with the people that he created. If you reject him, he becomes not I am. It rejects his very existence. If we don't follow him and honor him above ourselves and focus on what he's doing for us instead of what we're doing for him. Well, fortunately, this is not the end of the story. Fortunately, this is not at all the end of the story. If we turn to chapter 1, verse 10, and we're going to read through chapter 2, verse 1. It's kind of an historical accident why this first verse of chapter 2 got separated from the rest of chapter 1. In the Hebrew text, the first chapter actually ends at the end of verse 9 because it kind of completes a thought. Frank, could you read this for us? Read verse 10 and 11 and chapter 2, verse 1. Oh, that's good, Frank. You're getting like Norma. You got so excited about reading scripture that you just kept on going right there. Well, you get a little teaser for next week then, yeah. If you don't understand what it's talking about, you'll have to come back. What he's saying is that by nature, this is what we are. We, by nature, are Gomer. By nature, we're drawn to the world. By nature, we are Jezreel. Even when we want to serve God, we do it in the wrong way. We do it with aggression and self-will instead of humility and sacrifice and nonviolence. We are by nature lo ruhama. We by nature don't deserve God's mercy or relationship with him. We are by nature lo ami. We're by nature not his people. But God turns it all around. God declares it to be different. Not because lo ruhama and lo ami did some great thing to get his attention. Not because Jezreel all of a sudden shaped up. Not because Gomer all of a sudden became the happy homemaker. Because God declares it to be so. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, and we can only be justified by our good works and our sincere intention to build a great church for God. I think you realize I misquoted that. We can only be justified by God's grace that comes through Jesus Christ. When a man does not work, when a man does not try to work, but trust God who justifies the wicked, Romans 4:5, his faith is credited as righteousness. Credited as righteousness, not actually righteous. We're so fixated on trying to be righteous that we don't realize we're already credited with righteousness. You and I are never going to be righteous. We're always going to be Gomer. All the pretensions that we have and all the babbling that we do about all the great things we're going to do is just hot air. And it's one of the ironies of human nature that the more loudly we profess that it's not about us and we just got to be humble and accept God's grace, so often it's like Ethel Mertz apologizing to her husband. We're really just trying to have it both ways. It's not about us, not about us. Oh, but we need to be doing this, and you need to be doing that. You need to believe what I believe. You know, in the church today, we've got our own Pharisees, and they do have better marketing groups than the crew in the New Testament. You know, we've got doctrine Pharisees, we've got evangelism Pharisees, we've got worship Pharisees, we've got Bible study Pharisees. There are even grace Pharisees, people who use grace as a means of aggressively pushing their own agendas. What he's trying to tell us is, you don't need to be the pushers, the movers, the people who initiate stuff. You just need to understand how glorious God's grace is, how gracious he is, how loving he really is. And here's the things that happen when we accept that. This is an ancient promise. I wrote these scriptures in Genesis. We don't have time to read them. But remember, all the way back in Abraham's day, God promised Abraham his descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sands on the seashore. And God is faithful to that promise. It never depended on whether they were faithful to him or not. Never depended on whether they were good or not. It's just a promise from God that he fulfilled. Always took care of them. Always let them live no matter what they did. But when they can accept the fact that they are by nature lo ruhama and lo ami, all of a sudden, he says, in that very place where it was said to them, you're not my people, it's all of a sudden God's going to declare it to be different. They haven't changed, but God wants a relationship with them so much that he looks out and he says, I want a relationship with these people. That's what they're like. Well, I still want a relationship with them. And the interesting thing is that God's grace flows freely to prostitutes and it flows freely to Pharisees alike. Even if you reject the lessons of lo ami and lo ruhama, even if we persist in our stubbornness and our insistence that we're going to build some great thing for God, he still loves us. He still wants us. If we're faithless like Gomer and wander off and find other lovers, he still loves us and still wants us. One of the messages when Jesus says, go and learn what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, it's not just talking about, I want you to be merciful. What it's saying is even deeper than that. It cuts to the heart of God's relationship with us. I want my relationship with you to be based on mercy, not sacrifice. We just don't understand how powerful God's grace is. That's why we look out there and we judge all those other religious groups. That's why we get this false image that we've got to get out there and correct everybody and save everybody and tell them the truth because they're screwing it up and we're not. That's why we get into these ridiculous doctrinal arguments. And I apologize for the redundancy. That's why people act in the church the way that they act in the world. You know, in the world, you get all these ridiculous political candidates out there, and again, sorry for the redundancy, arguing about who's going to do the best, and we got to get rid of this guy because he's screwing everything up, and you got to elect me or otherwise the country's going to blow up. And it's just as ridiculous when we get into arguments about methods or doctrine or anything silly like that. Because God's grace is so powerful. It can save prostitutes. It can save Pharisees. It'll even save you and me. Now, the other things that happen are even better if we can get a dim appreciation of it, because one of the things he says, Isaiah, here's where the historical background is marginally important. Hosea lived in a lifetime when God's own people were even split into two different kingdoms, and they were even at each other's throats a lot of the time. One of the things that happens, if you can back off of that feeling that we've got to do it and we've got to work hard and we've got to do this and that, it brings unity. It brings the ability to work together with your brothers. It lets Judah and Israel come back together. This is one of his promises. And it's interesting what he says. Now, here again, your text of your Bible will vary depending on what version you have. He says, the people of Judah and Israel, in verse 11, will be reunited, and they'll appoint one leader. In the Hebrew, it doesn't say leader. It's just a typical thing. The NIV was written by people from America and Great Britain who are fixated with leaders and rulers and stuff like that. It actually says head. They will have one head. And the ultimate fulfillment is, of course, Jesus, the head of the body, the head of the church. That Jesus, even more than Hosea is prophesying, the grace of Jesus can break down all the barriers, between Jew and Gentile, not just between Israel and Judah. And it talks about how, my brothers and sisters, you can say to your brothers, my people, and to your sisters, my loved one. In other words, we're so fixated on how do we bring about unity? What do we teach so that everyone will agree on it? What kind of method will we come up with so that everyone will get excited about it? And it's actually the opposite. All our pretensions to be worthy of being God's people, to be worthy of God's grace, to be worthy of being called the children of God, just make it harder. It's when we stop that all of a sudden things change. So when we just accept it on the grace that it is. God's grace is so powerful. It could forgive people for stuff you'd never imagine. It's not necessary for us to get it right. It just isn't necessary. It's never been necessary because it depends on God's grace, and it's so powerful. Now, a little trivia before we go. Start off the spring with a little sports trivia. What two men are honored with an exhibit in the Baseball Hall of Fame even though they never had any official connection with the game of baseball? Jesse Owens and Woody Hayes, two great Buckeyes. Maybe they did something great in baseball too. Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, two of our renowned presidents. Maybe they did something for the game of baseball. Or is it two other presidents, William Howard Taft and Franklin Roosevelt? It's Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, pretty funny guys. Maybe they did something funny. Jimmy Stewart and Anthony Perkins, those are two stars of two classic baseball movies. Who thinks it's Jesse Owens and Woody Hayes? All you fanatic Buckeye fans are going to feel awful guilty if that turns out to be the answer, aren't you? Well, it's not. Is it Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt? What about William Howard Taft and Franklin Roosevelt? Well, you know, William Howard Taft is the one who invented the seventh inning stretch. I don't know if you know that. Yeah. Franklin Roosevelt is renowned in baseball history. When the World War II started, he specifically told the baseball teams they could keep playing baseball even though the war was on. But that's not the answer. Jimmy Stewart I put up here because we all know how Phil feels about Jimmy Stewart. Anthony Perkins is actually, Phil does not like Jimmy Stewart. And people get on me for quoting Leon Trotsky. And he's sitting there, doesn't like Jimmy Stewart. Which is more un-American, I ask you. Jimmy Stewart was the star of The Stratton Story, a classic baseball movie about a true story about a major league player who only had one leg. Anthony Perkins is genuinely one of Linda's favorites because he's the star of one of Linda's very favorite movies, and you'll have to ask her what it is. But he also was a star of a different movie called Fear Strikes Out. It's a great movie about another true story about Jimmy Pearsall, a man who was tormented by mental problems and yet was able to be a Major League Baseball player. But the answer is Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, the comedians. Because they had a famous comedy routine that they did on radio and in movies called Who's On First? It was Bud Abbott played the manager of the local baseball team, and Lou Costello wanted to learn the players on the team. And Bud said, well, you know, the players on our team, they have kind of funny names. We have Who's On First, What's On Second, I Don't Know Who's On Third. And so Lou says, yeah, that's what I want to know, who's on first? And so Bud says, yes. Well, what's the guy's name on first? No, what's the guy's name on second? Well, I want to know who's on first. Who's on first? Yes. Who's on first? Well, I don't know. No, he's on third base. You don't want to do that. Well, it goes on for several minutes, and it's hilarious. And so they're honored with an exhibit in the Baseball Hall of Fame just because the comedy and the game of baseball, tying it together, it's kind of a classic American thing. Well, the reason I mentioned Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, because they're an interesting story in themselves. Lou Costello was a professional comedian from when he was very young. Very funny man, very good at telling jokes, had lots of funny expressions on his face and lots of funny noises that he made, and very creative, came up with a lot of real good joke ideas. Bud Abbott is what they call in old-time show business the straight man. And he actually was not originally a professional show business person. He was in the business side. He loved show business. He was told from where he was very young he had no talent, so he liked to be around the theater by working in the office. He was working in the front office at this theater in Brooklyn when Lou Costello came in to do a live show in this theater in Brooklyn. Lou Costello had a straight man who would just kind of set up his jokes. You know, a guy that just would just make comments, and then Lou would make a joke about it, and Lou would get to be funny, and everyone would laugh at him. Well, Lou's straight man got sick that day in Brooklyn, and he was in a panic. You know, I got this show. I can't do it without a straight man. I got to have someone to set up my jokes, and it's this long act that someone's got to learn in a hurry. And someone said, well, you know, we got this guy, Abbott, who works in the office there. He's a real sharp guy. You know, I'm sure he wouldn't be any good at it, but at least he would learn it. He's got a good memory. He would learn your act, and it might not be as good as you're expected, but at least you could tell your jokes. You know, say, we'll give it a try. Well, Bud Abbott was perfect. And if you've ever seen, you know, they went on to do all kind of movies and radio shows and TV shows. If you've ever seen their act, Lou is the funny one. Bud Abbott is just the normal guy. He has this real, real flat, deadpan voice, and he just reacts to things the way a normal person would. And his characters in the movies usually are not very sympathetic. Lou's the one that you like. Lou's the one that gets all the attention. He gets all the jokes. He does all the funny stuff. There's some crazy situation, and Bud will just say, ah, come on, you know, it's not a problem. And Lou, he's always makes all these jokes about it. So Lou gets all the laughs and everything like that. Well, because of the way they worked, they were a team for many years. And Lou Costello always insisted in their contract that the profits not be split 50-50. He always insisted that they'd be split 60-40. But, as Adrian Monks like to say, here's the thing. He insisted that Bud Abbott get the 60%. Even though he was the funny one, and he got all the laughs, and he was the so-called headliner, he insisted that his partner, Bud, get the 60% just for sitting there and letting Lou make fun of him all the time. And people always would ask, whenever they would sign a contract, people were always surprised by that. You're the funny one. You're the talent. Why would you give him so much more money than you? And Lou Costello always said the same thing. He used to say, comedians and movie stars are a dime a dozen, but a good straight man is awful hard to find. You know the reason why I mentioned that? God's the ultimate straight man. God lets us get the attention. God lets us feel as if we're doing some great thing to him, when in reality, we're messing it up far worse than a bunch of store mannequins could mess it up. In reality, we got a great church and we're doing all these great things. It's just silly. It's just ridiculous for us to have that kind of pretension, because the story is about God. It's about God's grace and God's mercy. And yet God is like Bud Abbott. He'll just stand there and set us up with the perfect straight line, the perfect situation to make us look good, to make us feel great about ourselves, to make us get the laughs and the acclaim and the applause. And God just sits there hoping that maybe someone in the audience will stop and think, there's a real good straight man behind this. This is what our relationship with God is like. It's not about what we do to serve God or to please God or to be worthy of God. It's how far out of his way God has gone, not just to accept us, but to love us. And not just to love us, but to lavish his attention on us and to let us look good and to let us feel good when we don't deserve to. And this is where the book of Hosea starts. And this is the foundation of what it means that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. That he wants us to understand that's what our relationship with him is about. Thank you very much for your patient attention. We only went a couple minutes over this week, so we're off to a good start. And we'll see you next week.